Hello, and well done for downloading BBC Inside Science, first broadcast on the 23rd of October 2025. I'm Marnie Chesterton. Coming up, a new pregnancy test for skeletons, and is the Met Office running out of human weather monitors? I'll be meeting one of their volunteers and asking why this isn't all automated. Plus, science broadcaster Caroline Steele joins me to pick through the latest science discoveries of the week. What can we expect, Caroline?
So, volcanoes could be responsible for ice on Mars. Scientists might be able to make mice have periods, and a sonic surprise for bat scientists.
Exciting. OK, stay tuned for all that. But I wanted to start with a story that earlier this week brought a tear to my eye and some words to the eye of 70-year-old Sheila Irvine. Take a listen to this.
Did you ever imagine that you'd be able to read a book again?
Never. Never on your Nelly.
Very impressive. Very good.
Joyous TV there as implant patient Sheila described herself as one happy bunny to the BBC's medical editor, Fergus Walsh. Sheila is registered blind. She lost her sight to an age-related condition, and yet there she was punching the air as she successfully read words for the first time in years, all thanks to her eye implant. She was one of five people in the UK to get one, which, when coupled with some special glasses, has opened Sheila's eyes to a world of reading and Sudokus. Joining me to explain the science of the so-called bionic eye is Professor Francesca Cordero, an ophthalmologist at Imperial College London. Francesca, a bionic eye, does that go too far?
In terms of progress, I don't think it does go too far. It is a huge improvement on anything that has been put forward before. It is allowing people who really have lost their central vision to see again.
Can you give me a recap on how this eye implant, this Prima, works?
Yes, of course. So the centre of it is an implant that actually is implanted under the retina. So it's very close to the anatomical way the eye works. Person puts on a pair of glasses which has a camera. That camera actually records the image. That image is then converted and actually sharpened by a type of little transducer box which sits near the patient but is wireless. So this is the other big advance. And then infrared light is projected onto the implant, which produces a high contrast image.
Okay, and the retina is the bit at the back?
The retina is, yes. So if you think about the eye being like a pinhole camera, the very back of that pinhole camera is where the retinal or the film of the eye is, but the lights have to come through your pupil actually to focus on the macula, which is the sharpest point of vision. Now, in geographic atrophy, that's the point that is atrophied, and that's why people cannot see, because that central vision is lost.
This sounds sci-fi, bionic eye. How did we get here?
So actually, it's been a concept that's been around forever, and I cannot remember the name of the guy in Star Trek.
Oh, LaForge.
Okay. You're obviously a fan.
He had the...
The band of glasses.
The band.
The goldish, yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's definitely a hair clip. Anyway.
Okay. No, I think it was an insight into the future, because it was literally, he was blind and that was his way of seeing. So it's, the concept's been around. There've been different types of sort of versions. There is one already approved, but it's not as good as this one in terms of the resolution of the image. I think where this is different is, firstly, it's wireless. Secondly, the implant goes underneath the retina. The previous one went above it. And third, this is really quite high contrast. So it's like, I think it's 368 from memory impulses that can be stimulated on the chip. And the previous one was probably about a sixth of that, around 60.
I mean, why is the eye such a good part of the body to use this technology on?
Well, the very simplistic way of putting it is it's the only transparent part of the body. So just as, you know, we use our eyes to look out, it also allows us to project the image going in. And that ability to produce an electrical impulse, which can then go along the optic nerve to the brain, is preserved in some of these diseases because that nerve is still active. In fact, the peripheral retina is still functioning. So another big improvement with this implant is that it allows people to still use their peripheral retina, but only really augments that central vision. And that's one of the reasons actually why they have the infrared light. It's to allow natural light to still stimulate the periphery.
I'm thinking of some sort of analogy. It's like if you've got a touch screen and sort of part of it is broken, then this implant can go behind the broken bit but still allow the rest of the touch screen to function as
yes,
normal.
Yes, and if you think of your touch screen and reading, if you had a touch screen and the central bit wasn't working, we would naturally go around the edges, yes. But it would mean that the sharpest definition of vision had not been preserved because, you know, as I said earlier, if you think of the pinhole camera effect, our eye is designed so the sharpest point of vision is this area called the macula or the fovea, to be precise. So you would still need on your touch screen some way of ensuring that sharpest vision is intact. And that's really what this implant allows.
Is there going to be a Star Trek future where someone who has no vision at all has an entirely bionic eye fitted in and just sort of clips into place, you know, you've got the glasses,
yeah, yeah.
You've got the implant.
So there are different things that are going towards this goal. There is an audacious goal that is being done at the moment. In fact, we're part of this this program, which is the whole eye transplantation. Going back to the Star Trek guy, it could well be that it's going to be very acceptable for people who have lost their central vision to actually go around with the glasses like this.
Well, it's really great to hear about all sorts of transformations, but thank you so much for coming on to Inside Science and telling us about the bionic eye.
Thank you very much.
At the start of this programme, I promised you a new pregnancy test for skeletons, which may have left you scratching your head. Wonder no longer. Scientists from the University of Sheffield have come up with a way of extracting hormones from human remains dating as far back as the 1st century AD. And yes, that can work as a kind of pregnancy test for ancient bones. Joining me now to discuss what this can tell us about our past, beyond the obvious, is bioarchaeologist at the University of Lancashire, Brenna Hassett. Welcome, Brenna.
Hi.
Let's start with the obvious. Why do you need something like this? Isn't it obvious if a woman died with a child inside her, wouldn't you find a second body?
Well, that's putting a lot of faith in archaeologists, which generally I would. However, that's not actually the only bit of information about pregnancy you might want. There are a lot of cases where, for instance, a woman might die shortly after delivering a baby from complications, from infections. And you'd want to know, has that woman been recently pregnant? And that would help us understand what kinds of conditions killed women in the past.
Okay, so how has this research actually tested the pregnancy?
So this is actually pretty clever. Part of that scientific experiment that this paper is talking about is we don't really know how to look for hormones, but this is one of the steps into figuring out how do we get hormones. So this is taking an enzyme analysis method. So it's basically like a home pregnancy test, a little bit souped up. What they do is they actually take the little bits of bone and teeth and they powder them, they grind them up, they drill them with a micro mill, pop them out, and sticking them essentially in a test that, much like a pregnancy test, looks for three of the major sex steroid hormones. So estrogen or oestrogen, progesterone, and testosterone.
And those are the markers of if someone's pregnant or not, are they?
Yeah, so those hormones appear in different levels depending on biological sex and whether or not you are pregnant. So progesterone particularly is the one that's really important, that pregnant women have lots of progesterone. So if you're looking at, as this study does, some skeletons that were found with fetal remains, some skeletons that were male, some skeletons that were found that were female but not with fetal remains, they've gone through and tested which ones of these show signs of elevated progesterone or estrogen to figure out, can we use this skeleton pregnancy test?
I mean, that's really cool science, but I'm just wondering why this kind of research looking into pregnancy in ancient humans, why is that important from an anthropological perspective?
Well, for one thing, we actually don't know much about women, women's lives, and kind of our species' reproductive history. As a discipline, anthropology has a real problem asking questions about certain aspects of the life cycle, particularly those experienced by women. So our species is the weirdest one on the planet. We do crazy things like shut off reproduction halfway through our life cycles. And we also have very, very rapid pregnancies for the kind of primate we are. We basically reproduce really fast. You may have noticed we are the most numerous ape on the planet. All of these things are evolutionary sort of choices that we've made along the way. So being able to tell whether a skeleton was pregnant or not may seem a little bit, you know, by the by, but it's actually really, really important for how we understand how people lived in the past and how we got to be this weird species that we are. And quite frankly, a lot of these questions have not been asked because people have not been that interested in them. So this is actually a really exciting paper.
And what about the hormone aspect of things? I mean, I mentioned you're a bioarchaeologist. Is hormone testing in human remains something that you normally do? Is this a new way of looking at our past?
This is pretty new. So only a handful of people have had a go. It just takes us a while to see if we can make fancy new technologies work on really old bones. You can think about, for instance, the work of Svante Paabo, who, you know, only a short while ago gave us ancient DNA that allowed us to discover entire new species from, you know, a single finger bone. We're now doing that with proteomics, which is ancient protein studies. All of these are kind of technical skills people are suddenly applying to older and older questions.
My favourite is all of the weird and wonderful stuff that you can tell by scraping plaque off ancient teeth.
This is the best possible study because dental calculus, I mean, you are what you eat, but even if you don't eat it, your dental plaque, if you skip your dentist visit, will tell a future archaeologist all about the pathogens you encountered, the foods you ate, the recreational substances you may have consumed. There's a lot in dental calculus.
And a big mystery for humans is why we go through the menopause. Is this hormone information going to kind of help unpick that mystery?
Well, this is one of the big hopes. So my personal interest, I'd love to know more about how humans got their life cycle. For a long time, we thought only humans ever went through a chemical menopause. And, you know, elephants were off there reproducing at 70. Here we are shutting things off by 50. And then we found out that the toothed whales, the sort of danger dolphins, so your narwhals and your orcas, they also go through a chemical menopause. Suddenly, chimps do it. So we have no idea how our evolutionary history got us to this point. But if we can start tracking the actual hormonal signatures that tell us when humans turn off reproduction, all the way back down to, say, you know, our fossil relatives, that would be an incredible thing.
Brenna Hassett, thank you so much for coming on to Inside Science and telling us about some intriguing new research.
Thank you so much for having me.
The email to get in touch is insidescience@bbc.co.uk. Now, have you ever wondered when the weather forecast comes on the radio and they tell you the wettest place in the country, how they know? Yes, the Met Office has all sorts of satellites and instrumentation, but they also have thousands of volunteers who go out every morning to check the level of rainfall and report their findings. I went to meet one such volunteer, Stephen Burt, and his wife Helen, at their home in Berkshire. to find out why, in a world of digital automation, we still rely on an old-fashioned rain gauge. Hello.
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 Welcome.
Morning.
Nice to meet you. Would you like a drink?
A cup of tea would be great.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Fine.
Thank
I'll
you
go
so
put
much.
The kettle on.
Wow. Can you describe to listeners what we can see out the window?
Well, what we have is a fully fledged automatic weather station. The white boxes are Stevenson screens, and inside there, there's temperature monitoring equipment. So that's how we measure the air temperature. The thermometer is enclosed in a louvered box so that the air can blow through, but it keeps the sunshine and the rain off the thermometers, because otherwise, of course, you'd get an incorrect reading. Up at the very top, we have a solar radiation sensor, which measures the strength of sunshine. We have a three-cup anemometer, which is slowly going round. We have a wind vane on the other side, telling us wind speed and direction. A little further down, we have a visibility and present weather sensor. And then the box at the bottom is basically all the wiring. And, of course, at the ground level, there's the rain gauges, which are probably the single most important point of this morning. So would you like to come out and have a look at them?
Absolutely. It's 10 o'clock on the dot.
So, you'd like to come out? What I'm holding in my hand is a measuring cylinder. So this is what we pour the water from the rain gauge bottle into, and then we just measure how many millimetres of rain we have. So you see it's very sensitive. The bottom scale is only 0.1 millimetres. So a typical rain day would have between 2 and 5 millimetres. A very wet day would have 25, 30. The wettest day I've ever recorded had 81, which caused a lot of significant flooding. But let's walk over to the rain gauge. So this is a British standard rain gauge with a deep funnel. The deep funnel is there so that if it hails or snows, it keeps the hail in.
I should say it's about the size of a wine cooler.
It's what's known as a 5-inch rain gauge because the aperture is 5 inches across. And so from there, the rain falls into the funnel, and then from there, it falls into the bottle. And as you can see this morning, there is the grand total of zero. But in a very wet day, and the bottle can be almost full. And so you'll need to do this measurement several times. But that's basically it.
Joining me in Stephen's garden was Professor of Climate Science at the University of Reading, Ed Hawkins, who leads a citizen science project called Weather Rescue. Tell me about your project.
Although we've taken these measurements across these islands for a very long time, 2 centuries and more, unfortunately a lot of that data was locked up still on pieces of paper, stored very carefully in the Met Office archives, and it was unavailable to scientists to use. And so back in 2020, when the lockdowns happened, those sheets had luckily been scanned, and so we put those images online and asked for some volunteers to help us transcribe those invaluable rainfall amounts into a computer. The next target on our list is the daily rainfall sheets. So although we've done the monthly amounts, there are 100 million daily rainfall amounts going back to the 1870s still on paper. But that is probably a too big a project for volunteers. So we're actually going to need some AI help, I think.
There's a long history of recording rainfall, right?
Yes, we invented a lot of this standard technology back in the 1860s or so. The first measurements of rain in the country were in 1677, which is an extraordinarily long time ago. So now we have 200 years of continuous monitoring of rainfall in every location across these islands. And so once we have that 200 years, we can then start looking at whether the rainfall has changed over that period. There's an overall trend for getting much wetter on these islands. And so that the wettest month of the year has got about 20% wetter. So this is why having this old data is so valuable to allow us to draw that connection between what's going on with our greenhouse gas emissions, which is warming the climate, which is causing the rainfall to increase.
The director of the British Rainfall Organisation in 1910, when he was doing his annual report, there were so many rainfall observers in the country, about 5,500. He famously said that he could go in a balloon, bearing in mind this is before we all had cars and so on, he could go up in a balloon and come down anywhere in the British Isles and he would be within 5 miles of a rainfall observer that he knew.
What happens to the daily measurements that Stephen records?
So they get collected from all across the country, from the hundreds and thousands of people who are doing this at the same time every day, and they get sent to the Met Office and the Environment Agency, And within a few hours, the Met Office can make a map about how much rain had fallen yesterday. At the moment, there's around about 2,500 rain gauges which report every day. They may only send their observations in once a month, but that's the data that we have to reconstruct the rainfall across the country. It used to be much more, and our network is unfortunately declining. It's partly because many of the people taking the observations are volunteers, and sadly many of them are passing away or no longer able to take those measurements.
Can't you just digitise it all? Do you need people like Stephen?
Having that manual connection with the same technology is what gives us great confidence. You can't take these measurements with this copper rain gauge in an automatic way.
And instruments fail, power fails, get a big storm and you might lose power for a whole area, you might lose all the records. A big snowstorm, the rain gauges can be buried. Even bird droppings in the funnel can stop the records. On an automatic gauge, you won't necessarily notice until somebody thinks, oh, we haven't had any rain for 10 days. But if you're measuring it daily and you pick the funnel out, you can immediately see the funnel's blocked.
Can you tell me what it means to be part of this network?
I think it's contributing something to society and to science and to the meteorological record. After I've gone, my records will still be a part of the Met Office archive forevermore. And it's important to know it might only be a very small part in one individual station, but nonetheless, you're contributing to a larger body of science as a whole. And that's important to me.
And that's a great legacy. Thanks to Professor Ed Hawkins and Stephen, whose garden really does look like a mini meteorological station. And if any of the younger generations with enough outside space for a rain gauge fancy trying this, we're going to put details on the website. Check out the website for links to sign up. Caroline Steele is with me in the studio, eager to share the latest science discoveries. So first off, you're taking us to Mars.
Yes. So Mars's equator has thick sheets of ice sort of hiding underneath the surface, which is quite odd. And scientists for a long time have thought that's quite odd because the equator, like here on Earth, is the warmest part of Mars. So why is there ice there?
OK, and new science has solved the mystery?
Yes. So according to a recent paper in Nature Communications, basically by simulating volcanic eruptions on Mars, scientists have found that over the course of millions of years, these eruptions could have blasted water from the interior of the planet up into the atmosphere, 65 kilometres up into the atmosphere, because there's not much gravity on Mars, so eruptions look huge.
Oh, I really wish I'd seen that.
Yeah. And then the water would freeze and snow down to form layers of ice, and then it would get covered in volcanic ash, which kind of provides an insulating layer, helping preserve it until now.
Now, we've known that there's water on Mars for a while now, right? Under the surface.
Yes, and there being water at the poles sort of makes more sense. This kind of patch of water around the equator has been more confusing. But it's important to understand it better because if we do terraform Mars, if we do try and live on this planet, we'd probably want to live at the equator because it's definitely the mildest. It's still pretty cold. And we'd need to get water from somewhere. And this could be a potential water source in the future.
Okay, location, location, location. Science says the equator has the water and it's got the best climate.
Sounds good.
Back on Earth and menstruating mice.
Yes. So this is actually sort of similar to what you were talking about with our reproductive history. We don't know much about female biology. We don't know much about periods because historically, scientists have been men and there's a lot of stigma around periods and menstruating. So it hasn't really been prioritised. But there's another reason why periods are really hard to study. Any guesses why?
Is it to do with mice?
Yes.
Which we normally use as a lab animal.
Yes. And what don't they do?
They don't menstruate.
Yeah. So humans are kind of weird in the fact that we have periods. So it's hard to study periods when our sort of classic lab mouse and most other species don't have them. But according to a preprint, so a paper that hasn't been peer-reviewed yet, scientists have engineered lab mice to get a period in response to certain drugs.
Oh, lucky mice.
Yeah. So, yeah, I do feel quite bad for the mice. So this is what happens. So the researchers trick them into sort of a pregnant state by raising their progesterone levels, which is a hormone that increases during pregnancy. They then inject a fluid that sort of pushes against the inside of the uterus, which mimics an implanting embryo. And then when they stop this progesterone treatment, the uterine cells a shed, which is a period. It lasts for 3 to 4 days. And it is early days, but according to this paper, it looks similar to human menstruation. And there's hope it could help understand conditions like endometriosis. But yes, there are obviously some real differences between an induced mouse period and a human period. But it might be better than what we've got so far, which is not a lot of data.
And finally, you promised me a surprise and bats.
A sonic surprise to do with bats, yes. So I want to talk about the greater nocturnal bat, one of Europe's largest and most endangered bats. And they usually eat insects. But in the past, DNA analysis of their poo has basically shown traces of songbirds, suggesting that they might sometimes eat larger prey. But a paper was published in Science a couple of weeks ago where researchers have been studying these bats by basically fixing a sort of tag, a sort of backpack to their backs, which records their position and the sounds that they make. And bats are quite noisy because they hunt using echolocation, where they basically send out sounds, it bounces off stuff, and they use that to locate things. And so recently, an amazing recording was made of a 3-year-old female bat out hunting one night in Spain. And when listening back to this overnight audio, scientists heard an unfamiliar noise. So I want to play you a clip of this audio, and the credit goes to Laura Stidschult. You look quite stressed. Basically, using this recording and altitude data, the researchers are able to kind of construct the story of what happened with this bat overnight. So she flew to an altitude of nearly a mile and then suddenly dived to cross paths with a robin. Oh. And then the bat and this poor robin engaged in a kind of tussle. And then for 23 minutes... the bat's echolocation squeaks were broken up by chewing and crunching as the bat kept flying while eating this robin, sort of like the equivalent of talking with your mouth full.
Okay, that's enough. That's enough of that.
So basically, the reason why this seems to be happening at this time of year is robins migrate in spring and autumn. And during that migration time, they fly at night, which they don't normally do. So they suddenly sort of become on the menu for these bats, which shows how adaptable they are. They can suddenly go to eating prey much, much larger than what they're used to when the environment allows. So, yes, I'm sad for the robin, impressed by the bat.
Caroline Steele, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And that's us out of time, although there is just enough of it to say that this is my last time as a regular presenter on Inside Science. I've been doing this for 5 years now, and it's been a blast and a privilege. Thank you so much to all the scientists and producers that I've bothered over the years. But for now, farewell. The science rolls on as ever, don't worry, and Victoria Gill will be here next week. Bye for now. You've been listening to BBC Inside Science with me, Marnie Chesterton. The producers were Ella Hubber, Tim Dodd, Jonathan Blackwell and Claire Salisbury. Technical production was by Searle Whitney. The show was made in Cardiff by BBC Wales and West, and if you want to discover more fascinating science content, head to bbc.co.uk, search for BBC Inside Science, and follow the links to the Open University.